We're now about to take a journey to the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of African American History and Culture, right here in Baltimore, to take a walk through their latest exhibit, Ruth Star Rose, Revelations of African American Life in Maryland and the World, which opened last month. The show is about a very unique world that few of us have known about or ever seen that took place right here in Maryland on the Eastern Shore. It's featuring the paintings and artwork of a woman named Ruth Star Rose, who was white, moved here from the North with deeply anti-racist feelings in the early part of the 20th century. And the artwork features African Americans portrayed with dignity, which was absolutely rare for that time. We have conversations with people descended from the people who were painted in those pictures. It also exhibits the most comprehensive visual interpretation of spirituals ever to appear in the United States during that time. This exhibit runs through April 3rd, 2016. Over the course of this interview, you're going to hear a few main voices. Jeffrey Mone, who is a family descendant of the people Ruth Star Rose illustrated. Dr. Barbara Paca, an art historian and one of the curators of this exhibit who discovered the work of Ruth Star Rose. Ted Mack, Reginald F. Lewis Museum board member, and Skip Sanders, executive director of the Lewis Museum. With Ruth Star Rose, Relations of African American Life in Maryland, Revelations of African American Life in Maryland and the World. And so as curator, give us a little history here. Where are we?
Well, I think you're in the center of the discovery of a cache of paintings that were unknown for nearly 80 years, and this is the first time they've been reassembled since 1933.
So a cache of paintings of what? Of whom? Why is this so significant?
Paintings of African-American people from Maryland who were painted by an artist with an unusual sense of self-pride and dignity and respect.
So who is Ruth Star Rose?
Ruth Star Rose was an artist who graduated from Vassar College in 1910 and went on to study at the New York Art Students League. And she stated in 1930 that it was her mission to portray the daily life of African American people, their work and their life and their spirituality. And her friends in New York supported her very much in her effort to do so. And she worked in one of the most isolated pockets of the Eastern Shore of Maryland. Her friends came down from New York to encourage her and to pursue their own work as artists.
How was it we discovered? It was part of the family?
I met Barbara Paca, who had actually been collecting Ruth Star Rose's work over the past 10 years. And I've been doing my family genealogy and research for quite a few years myself. The family did not know that these paintings existed because the people in the paintings, that at least were my family, have all passed away. And so this was quite a discovery for me as a family historian, and certainly for the family who are, you know, alive today. And it's like quite a legacy that they have left, my ancestors have left, you know, working with Ruth Star Rose and sitting for her, you know, as portrait, you know, subjects.
And Ruth Star Rose is part of the family.
No, actually, Ruth Star Rose and her family owned a nearby farm, actually nearby to the village where my family lived, and a few of them worked for her family as well at the Hope House. And so it's a small rural community, so everyone knows each other there, and so that's how she was acquainted with my family.
Where was this?
This is on the Eastern Shore, outside of Easton, and it's a little village called Copperville that she lived, as well as my family lived there as well.
And Ted Mack, so what is your role in all this?
We have a mutual friend, and this mutual friend, Barbara and I, is Barbara's cousin, and we served on the Historic Annapolis Board. And she asked if she could introduce me to Barbara, which she did. Barbara came armed with this exhibit and gave a presentation to me. It was like a PowerPoint presentation, but it was all from memory, and it was absolutely fantastic. I found myself singing Negro spirituals while I was looking at the work, and I said at that point that this has got to be shown in Maryland. And it took me some time to figure out how I could approach Gip and Leslie King Hammond and encourage them to journey with me to the location in Oxford where Barbara showed them the exhibit also. And Skip started singing.
Skip Sanders, the director of the museum. The
director of the museum started singing Negro Spiritual. Remember, I was humming the spiritual because I can't sing.
And what was that song? And speaking of Skip Sanders, he's walking. Skip, how are you?
Good to see you again, Mark. Always. How are you?
I'm very well. Good to see you as well.
I made the Mark Steiner show. I'm doing well.
Yeah, right. So what was the song? Now tell me about the song. What happened?
Roostar Rose paints to Negro spirituals. And as you will see, many of her paintings have Negro spiritual names.
That's the theme, yeah. So whatever we were looking at, you know, I just connected the spiritual to it and started singing it, yeah.
And what was the spiritual y'all were singing?
One was Go Down Moses.
Go Down Moses, okay.
In Egypt's land. That's and one had when they were flying, coming out of the air, and the angels were singing.
Oh, Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. That's what it was, yeah.
And it was so exciting because we could both relate to that. We, of course, were the senior ones in the in the room.
I'm the senior.
Let's take some bets on that.
And Skip can sing, so I left there saying, whatever we do, we're going to have some music with this because that's our culture. And that's the culture that Roostar Rose picked up. In fact, she taught Sunday school in the church, the Negro churches there in Copperville. And she has her handwritten list of students that were in various classes. The classes then were segregated by male-female. So she has a male list and a female list, and all handwritten, authentic. And we just found it very interesting. Jeffrey's family are very prominent on those lists. I think somewhere it's about 70% of the list, I believe.
Yes, I read through the list myself last year when Barbara first introduced the project to me, as well as today as I got to walk through the exhibit by myself. And I recognize so many of those names. They were my great aunts, my great uncles, my grandfather was one of them, his first cousins, and his aunts and uncles as well. It's a pretty moving exhibit, you know, for the family.
So before we take a kind of journey through the exhibit, I mean, Skip, tell me what was about this that you wanted to bring it here to the museum.
Oh, I think a couple of things especially. First of all, this museum is really focusing on Maryland African-American history and culture. And in that respect, the opportunity to really reach out to the magnificent Eastern Shore, loaded with history. What a legacy. I mean, it's a magnificent maritime culture and agriculture. But to be able to reach out to this community and extend the museum, you know, to the Eastern Shore is a great, great opportunity for us. I don't think we have had the opportunity to reach out as much as we really want to the Maryland community, much beyond the metropolitan area. So this was a chance we couldn't miss. Second thing is the story itself is so compelling. If you really think about this area and these people, some of them are descendants of Douglas and Tubman. But on the other hand, and again, this fits what the museum does, it's not just telling the stories of the iconic figures, but as you know, you've been through the permanent exhibit. We're really focusing maybe even more so on the ordinary work that African-American Marylanders did that certainly built the economy of the state just the way it did the country. And so we're lifting up the heroism that's in the people, not just in persons. And this, I mean, that's what Ruth did in painting these wonderful people in her community. A third reason, if you think about what's been going on recently, here's a story that keeps bringing home the point that Ted Mack makes all the time. American history's one history. It's not African-American history and then European-American history. It's one history, which is really a tapestry of so many cultures. And this is an inextricable thread that goes through that whole tapestry. So, and this story again tells that, because look at her relationship with these people belonging to the church, actually painting them in such a respectful and caring way, showing inclusion. You can walk around here and see where she's actually shown the communities together, and I've had the privilege of meeting her granddaughter, Brenda Rose, who knows so much about the family. And says the family came from the Midwest with that attitude. So if you can imagine coming to early 20th century Eastern Shore, Maryland, but inviting the people who work for you as well as your neighbors so that you've got an inclusive social gathering, I mean, that's saying something big. It's quite an example to set for Maryland.
Not a common occurrence on the Eastern Shore.
Certainly not, but you said that, not me.
I said that. I'll say it again.
not by any stretch of the imagination. First of all,
Barbara's being very quiet.
Roostar Rose was stepping out in an area that was very testy at the time.
It's a polite way of putting it.
Yes. And she had difficulty with the people surrounding her, but she stuck to her guns, and when they had entertainment, it was a one Maryland entertainment at their place. The people that worked for them were dressed accordingly and were always a part of the activity that was going on. And this did not set well with those who were just coming out of slavery and thought that it should be otherwise.
Well, I mean, for someone who spent a lot of time on the Eastern Shore and was a civil rights worker in Cambridge, Maryland in 1962 and 3, I know this story all too well. So the woman who made these paintings, so we're dancing around a bit, but it clearly is white.
Yes, very much so. But way ahead of her time in many fronts, including her social activism, her independence as a woman. She went where she wanted to go. She had some very influential friends. She made friends with Paul Robeson, Orson Welles. So you can see the progressive kind of thinking that she represented. So in so many respects, it's an interesting person. But for us, as interesting as she is, the opportunity to tell a story about this African-American community that she's painted. For instance, Mark, I don't know if you know, but some archaeological digging is going on there. Dale Glenwood Green from Morgan is quite certain that when it's over with, this area in Talbot County, not far from here, will be shown to be the oldest extant community of free African-Americans in the country. It'll predate Treme, which we take to 1812, but this is going back, it looks, to 1790. How about that? So how could you pass up the opportunity to tell this kind of story?
So we're sitting here in the center in the case, and what are you showing us here?
Well, here we have photographs of her guests at the Talbot Country Club.
Mark, do you know the Talbot Club in Easton?
Yes.
Okay, so this is called A Scene at the Talbot Club in September of 1914. Do you see the guest on the far left?
Yes.
What do you say for 1914?
Well, we're looking at it was seen in front of the club here, and one of the guests is black.
Mm-hmm. And very comfortable. He's very comfortable. He's a very elegant man. And I think that is a picture that, as a former civil rights activist in Cambridge, Maryland, you can probably relate to.
So, I mean, just look at that at the top.
That's
the two boys.
Roostar Rose's son and his best friend, George Mone, who's the same boy photographed in the pastel behind you. They're sitting on a log canoe. Roostar Rose was a great athlete, and she won log canoe races in 1930. So this is really a luxury yacht. And here is her son sharing an experience with a boy from Copperville, a member of the Mone family. One of the things you said early on that I really liked was your kind of confusion about whether she was black or white, and you didn't want to ask her race.
No, I was going to ask her. I have no problem asking that.
One of the things that we love is the confusion. I've given this talk to college students, and I don't show a picture of the artist until the very end, and they ask, who's that? So it's just how great she was at what she did. If you go to the NAACP and you look on the mantelpiece, you see the ashes of Gertrude Stein. Gertrude Stein wrote a book called Three Lies, which are short stories about people who worked for her, and it was unpublished in America. She had published it in France because the portraits of these members of staff made Americans a little uncomfortable. Roostar Rose is really the visual equivalent of Gertrude Stein. She's showing people who are self-respecting black people, who know who their forebears are, and they're very proud of it. And it's the way that she's capable of blurring the races that's interesting. We looked in our research of what happened the last time she had a solo show in Baltimore. was 1933, these paintings kind of went missing until recently. So we knew these paintings were in a show, so we went to the Pratt Library. And I want you to come over here and see what was happening that weekend. Thanksgiving weekend of 1933, as 2,000 National Guard were deployed to Salisbury near her home to control a white mob who was protecting lynchers who had just lynched George Armwood. So knowing the inherent danger, she went ahead and had her show featuring large-scale oil portraits of her African-American friends and neighbors.
Let's get this straight. The show of her show that opened in 1933 in Baltimore was done at the same time.
The lynching in Salisbury took place.
A white mob.
A
crazy white mob.
This is the book that Cheryl Neifel wrote about that lynching. Who's now head of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, lives here. Mm-hmm. She wrote about this, her entire book about this particular lynching that took place in the Eastern Shore. And so what was the juxtaposition between her, having the exhibit of these paintings in Baltimore and the lynching that took place on the Eastern Shore?
It was very dangerous for her to go ahead and have her show, but she did it. And you can see the same time Mencken is writing his fourth article about lynching, and it's called Revels in Transchoptankia. He writes it right before her show, and he calls that region of the Eastern Shore Transchoptankia. He just said, "You're all crazy. I don't know what's wrong with you." And so in the headlines, I kept on looking in the paper, the next headline was, "We're going to lynch Mencken next." So Baltimore Sun trucks couldn't drive to the Eastern Shore. They would be stoned. So he went ahead and continued writing, and she went ahead with her show. Now, she had, you know, her farm and her parents' farm very close to this area. So it was a very brave thing that she did.
What were you about to say? I'm sorry.
And now fast forward to this year, mm-hmm. What just happened in Baltimore? And where's her show? Her show is here in Baltimore.
Right, exactly. And these newsprints you have in the case here are obviously original prints from the Sun and from...
This is from the Newark Evening News, and this is Ruth Star Rose standing next to a painting of Clarence DeShields, who's this gentleman here. And she's saying, "I'm going to paint African-American people, and I'm also going to go to the Essex County Penitentiary, and I'm going to paint the incarcerated." This is an article from the Star Democrat of 1925. This is someone, a descendant, Ruth Star Rose.
The Salisbury paper.
The Easton Democrat is a Talbot paper.
Right, right.
So it's the Star Democrat, and her granddaughter gives me this piece of paper. It doesn't have any date on it, but it says, "We're having a party at Hope," providentially the name of their farm, "and we're only inviting African-American people to attend a Memorial Day garden party." And I thought, okay, what's the date? So I'm going through the research room, the Maryland room at the Talbot Library, and the librarian said, "Look, they don't publish black obituaries until the late 60s in Talbot County. So if you're looking for I was looking for the obituaries of the named because I couldn't figure out the date. And then Ruth Star Rose's great-nephew, Nathan Kernan, who's been fantastic in New York, said, "I have this collection of photograph albums and family kind of guest books, these big, expensively made leather-bound books, with names. Why don't you want to have a look?" And a doorman was going to throw them away in New York City. They belonged to a sort of relation of his. In that one of those books, next to President Wilson's signature and DuBose Hayward and kind of a who's who of intellectual history, was the guest list from 1930 honoring the colored citizens of Talbot County. I assumed that this article was from 1930, but it wasn't. This was the second party they had. This happened in 1925. So to just have a party, as you know, was inherently a dangerous thing to do. But it was the isolation of the community that allowed them to live an integrated life in a deeply segregated time. There's one painting that we want to share with you of Jeffrey's forebears.
I'm curious, as a family member, how shocking was this to see all this revealed?
It was amazing to me because I didn't know of Ruth Star Rose. I had actually seen her work as a child from a fresco that actually hung in the DeShields United Methodist Church in Copperville. I always wanted to know who did it, and I never knew until really it was last year when Barbara really introduced me to Ruth Star Rose and her work. And so this has been a really incredible experience and journey to not only see the paintings, but learn about her social activism through her artwork. And for my family to be a part of that, you know, that's something to be really proud of. And the values of, you know, social inclusion that Ruth Star Rose, you know, really portrayed in her work, you know, those are values that my family, those who are painted in some of these portraits, have passed on to us, you know, as the latter generations.
Were any of these part of your family lore? Had you heard about any of this growing up?
We had not. I had never heard of any of the paintings, that they even existed. And so this has been really an incredible find for us. And certainly me as a family historian, it really also helps put faces to names. But what the paintings also do is they also show who they were as people, you know, in a younger age. You know, as I sat here alone for a few minutes and heard my grandmother's voice playing in the background, singing spiritual music, and looking at the paintings, they just seem to come alive even more. Because I know the backdrop, I know the spiritualism that we had growing up and that was instilled in us through some of the people that are painted in these portraits.
I mean, this shows a painting by Ruth Star Rose called The Circus of 1930, and you see people having a wonderful time. You can see her husband with a mystery guest, we don't know who it is, entertaining everyone, and you can see on the left a segregated world of African-American people, and on the right, white people in attendance. But what's interesting is there's a kind of, you see this sort of clock-like movement within, and here you have her daughter and her son with their best friend, George Money, who's an African-American boy. And it's as if she's saying that this march of time is going to create an integrated world.
Did you know George Money?
I did not. He was a first cousin to my grandfather. The generation, most of the generation, except for a couple of survivors, have passed away. And so I did not know George Money. I know a couple of the other people in the other portraits.
All these portraits are ones that Ruth Star Rose painted over how long a period of time was this?
These portraits are primarily from about a 15-year span. We think from about 1925 to maybe 1940. And this is a portrait of Jeffrey's great-uncle?
Yes.
Bernard Money. And Jeffrey's being very modest. On top of being a top designer at Gensler, he's a very serious genealogist.
So Uncle Bernard was one of my grandfather's older brothers. I believe he was the oldest son. And so this is a painting of him as a duck hunter. But in the rural area that we were from, I know fishing was also very prominent. And what I love about this painting, it really kind of sums up his personality as well. He's a very quiet, reserved man. He lived most of his life in New Jersey once he left the Eastern Shore after this was painted, obviously. And then he retired and came back to Easton, but he would still often visit his siblings and the rest of the family for family reunions. Fishing parties were very big in my family. We loved to fish. I know my grandfather was also a hunter. And so this really kind of sums up his personality. He was a very pensive person, very reserved. You know, he wasn't the one, you know, creating the center of attention, but he was, you know, just a very solid, you know, figure, you know, in our family.
You know, here is an Elliott Brothers Drake decoy. This is like a Rolex watch, okay? And this is a double-twist Damascus steel shotgun. And so to portray this man who's clearly in his prime with confidence and, you know, fantastic accoutrement for hunting and really dressed as her brothers would be dressed to go out hunting, again, speaks volumes. I mean, I think people need to come and see this to really understand the magnitude. How would you feel if you saw all of your ancestors on the walls, whom you knew as old people, and you see them as innocent children or people in their prime, is one question. But then how would you feel if you saw a representation of their spirituality, Another reason why everyone assumed that Ruth Starr Rose was African American was because she had a solo show at Howard University. Another Marylander, James Porter, is a godfather of African American art history, and he taught at Howard University. He wrote that her collection of spirituals were the most comprehensive and sympathetic to date. She's selected by Alan Locke in 1940 to enter her work into a book called The Negro and Art. It's two spirituals. Paul Robeson is collaborating with her on a book of African-American spirituals the next year. It's assumed that she must be an African-American person. Of the spirituals, which are vast and beautiful, and we'll go look at them, she said, "I'm not doing anything original. I'm just documenting songs as the congregation sang them." And she would do one spiritual, like Swing Low Sweet Chariot, again and again and again, grind the stone all the way down, make an oil painting, make a serigraph, make a lithograph, until she got it right. And the congregation would tell her each time, "You didn't get that quite right." What's remarkable about her work is the fact that her notes survive. So she's writing about a song called The Old Ark's a Moverin', and the print is at the Met. I mean, these are not sort of that unknown. But she's talking about how spirituals are very real to the community and how The Old Ark's a Moverin' is about going to death, going home, as they would say. And she said it was really the only time that African-American people found justice in their life was the passage to death. So we actually have the notes that talk about how she felt about having to tell these stories as well and how it kind of hurt her to see the lack of justice in African-American communities. But she was relentlessly positive. So while her friends in New York, people like Mabel Dwight, you know, William Palmer, were portraying the injustices, she really tried to keep it positive.
You're listening to an interview I taped at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum about an exhibit that opened last month, Ruth Starr Rose, Revelations of African-American Life in Maryland and the World. There's more of this fascinating story when we come back. So stay with us after this break. Don't go away. Welcome back. We continue to take our trip to the latest exhibit at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of African-American History and Culture. It's called Ruth Starr Rose, Revelations of African American Life in Maryland and the World. It features an extensive collection of visual representations of spirituals and portraits from the early part of the 20th century of many African American families on the Eastern Shore. And the most unusual relationship this woman, who was white, Ruth Starr Rose, had with the African American community. Over the course of this interview, you're going to hear a few main voices. Jeffrey Mone, who is a descendant of the people Ruth Starr Rose illustrated. Dr. Barbara Packa, who is one of the two curators of this exhibit. Ted Mack, Reginald F. Lewis Museum board member. And Skip Sanders, who is executive director of the Lewis Museum.
This is Jonah and the Whale. And this is, again, a great example of the many ways in which she tells a story. This was in the Paris Exposition of 1937. But she did another smaller color silkscreen or serigraph, and she did at least two black and white lithographs, along with studies of the spiritual.
And let me ask, as we're going down looking at these, so where were these all these years?
I mean, they ended up in the Corcoran, the Philadelphia Museum of Art. You know, the prints ended up in pretty important collections, but because she was a woman, they were just kind of shuffled and lost and not really understood. This was in the New York Times Book Review. This is Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. And so she does a black and white lithograph and a color lithograph. This is a black and white and a color lithograph of the print I mentioned to you, The Old Ark's a Moverin'. And this is an oil painting that she did of Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. So she's always working and working to get it right. The Pharaoh's Army Got Drowned was, on a personal level, probably one of the more important works she did. She's quoted in the Christian Science Monitor of 1955 as writing that this was the first work of art, to her knowledge, that a white person had made for a black church. And this is what Jeff remembers from his childhood, this beautiful fresco.
So this fresco we're looking at now.
Well, it's called Pharaoh's Army Got Drowned.
This was in your church?
This was in my childhood church in Copperville. And I remember, you know, looking up at it every Sunday. This was actually in the altar, flanked by red velvet draperies. And it was really an important piece of the church and the center of the church. You know, it was, and there was also a cross that hung you know, just to the right of it, almost saying, you know, that the way this is painted, it's as if, you know, there's an African-American population in the painting, that it refers to the Exodus.
Right.
And, you know, they are going home, almost like a homegoing. And so this for me was always an important part of growing up into our church life. And to see it over 30 years later is remarkable to me. They did a wonderful job in restoring it. I almost didn't recognize it. I didn't realize it had so much color. And now that I'm older, from, you know, my memory of when I was 10 and 12 years old.
What's amazing to me, looking at the work that she did, as we're looking at Pharaoh's Army Drowned, the fresco, is that these were biblical stories, but the characters in her paintings are all African-Americans.
Yes.
And, you know, there's always been this giant battle inside the church between, do we have white images in the church, do we have black images in our churches, right?
Right?
And so here you have, she's way ahead in terms of painting the Exodus story with black Americans.
She was so far ahead of her time. Sitting there, you know, as a child, I never knew who the artist was of this painting until just last year. But she was so ahead of her time, and I really enjoyed getting to know the story behind her artwork, because, you know, I think it's a really poignant moment in time right now, especially with some of the racial tensions that we have currently in the U.S. and certainly the city, that, you know, I think there are some lessons to be learned from this exhibit, from her social activism of integration, a message of integration and equality among races. That I think these are lessons that we are still learning, I feel like, today.
To me, it's truly amazing to kind of feel this, in the sense that we're talking about, I keep going over and over in my mind, that we're talking about the Eastern Shore.
Right.
Right? We're talking about the Eastern Shore of Maryland, one of the most segregated, racist parts of the United States of America.
Right. Yeah, I mean, for me too. And also the time period in which she painted these images of not only the African-American spiritualism and the portraits, is that she's painted them with such respect, and there's a nobility about them at a time when other artists, especially white artists, would have painted black figures as entertainment, as minstrels, someone to be made fun of. And she has painted these subjects in my family with such a respect and equality, you know, as just human beings. And that's what I really appreciate, and I know my family does too.
A couple of examples for you is, you wonder who this angel is right here. This is an African-American soldier who lost his life in training in World War II. So she made this fresco to honor this young man who was the son of the minister. Now, if you look over here, you see a portrait by Mabel Dwight of Paul Robeson, and it's inscribed to Ruth Star Rose with love in 1930. The reason I'm showing you these is because at the unveiling of this fresco, we've read the letters in the Smithsonian, and she thanks her friends in New York for loaning her recordings of Paul Robeson. That spring, she actually has a party at her property on the Eastern Shore, and on the invitation, she says it's the special request that both races attend. This is 1941. Shortly before the party, just weeks before the party, if you look in this article here at the Montclair Times, she's with Paul Robeson, presenting him with two of her lithographs of spirituals, all right? So at this moment in history, Paul Robeson is not too popular with the American government. And she, in other articles, it turns out, is actually drawing him. And so we have a drawing from the concert right here in front of you. And you can see she's clearly got a front row seat, but she displays proudly American flags behind him. So she's saying Americans can be all kinds of people. And she's not just talking about color, she's talking about political beliefs and tolerance.
My mind still boggles of where we are in history and what actually happened. This is what she wrote?
Yes.
Do you want to read it?
Jeffrey.
Negro spirituals spring from a spiritual need that was once acute and is still very real. We must not forget that they are deeply religious songs. right now in the little remote churches all over the South. Quartets are singing for the people, not for radio fame, but for the simple Christian duty of helping souls to find heaven. Their groups of singers are in deadly earnest and full of religious zeal. They come out of the wheat fields and tomato patches, right from the threshing, the crab house, oyster shucking, to sing for their own people. Very many of these quartets cannot read a note of music, yet so phenomenal in their musical sense that they make an orchestral harmony with savage, haunting undertones out of a simple song. The singing of these Black Americans is one of the wonders of the New World.
Ruth Star Rose.
And to me, this really is also an important statement, because I feel like that's the environment I grew up in. My grandmother was an incredible example of, you know, singing not for fame, not to be noted, but because she enjoyed it and because of her spiritual beliefs. And she still sings and leads the choir to this day. And she plays the piano, and she is self-taught the piano. And she has been such a fixture in the community on the Eastern Shore that many churches and have invited her to be their pianist, to sing, to play by herself along with other choirs. And so I'm so proud. I'm so proud of her.
And she has been honored by the President Obama,
as well as the governor, for her service over 6 decades of music and bringing music to the community.
Your grandmother.
My grandmother.
So you see the picture over here.
We're looking at a picture of a mother, one drawing of a mother with a baby.
Right.
In a cradle.
So when my collaborator, Nina Krisheva, whom I believe you know from New School, and I started this project.
Yeah, Nina.
So she wrote the epilogue. So we were actually made the first discovery of a Ruth Star Rose. We were together. And we said, what is this Black artist who did this painting? This is a masterpiece. And we were told, no, this was a white artist. We had the same confusion you had, which is wonderful. And so Nina and I went on a quest to learn about her, and we would go to collections, and they'd say, well, we don't really want to show you that work. Why do you want to look at a rich white lady making fun of Black people? So we realized that these kind of middle-class white male curators had some kind of baggage that we didn't quite relate to. Mildly, and you know Nina, so this was a capital letters. So we looked at this study here, and we found that the name of it is Madonna. So, again, this speaks respect to me and the fact that the artist took the trouble to keep the studies and the final black and white lithograph, which is in her notes that we would collect the notes of the artist. It said, I'm going to show the power and emotion of a mother protecting her sleeping child. So this is a wonderful thing. Well, we went to a property.
This is 1934, by the way.
Yes. We went to a property and purchased this crib from a descendant of the artist. And this is the same cradle. If you look at the detail, it's matching that cradle. And we were told that it was a cradle from Hope House, from this very fancy house. So we had it analyzed, and this is an 18th century American cradle. So again, the fact that a family would lend their heirloom to the staff for their children is rather unprecedented for the period.
So now we're in a part called the Eastern Shore Paintings.
This just, again, Ruth Star Rose writes, again, it's when you're going through collections and you find the artist's notes. She's saying again and again, and her friends in New York are saying, nobody's done this before. She said, I'm going to chronicle the daily life of people, not as spectacles, but just people leading normal, productive lives. So this is a version of her house of Hope, and she's scaled it down. It's actually quite a big house. The driveway is 2 miles long. And it's because of the isolation and the length of that driveway that they could lead the integrated life that they led. So it was sort of a double-edged sword for them. This is a woman who worked for her, Mrs. Money, and it's called Supper Time. And you see Ruth Star Rose clocking in on the kind of honest austerity of this woman's life. This is of it's St. Michael's, the Fireman's Carnival, which was held at the bottom of the street called Hell's Crossing, shown here. And these are just people on the merry-go-round, enjoying the carnival. And this was written in the New York Evening Herald in 1934 as one of the prints that you really needed to see at a show in New York. So this artist's work is really quite revolutionary, even in New York City. Hell's Crossing, this is done about the time that her family entertained Dubose Hayward. He wrote his friend, who is a famous author called Hervey Allen, looks like my book Porgy's about to become an opera, and I need to kind of brush up on my African-American spirituals. So he signs the guest book at Hope in 1935, which is when he did Summertime. And this really reads as a scene from Porgy. This shows the Maryland crab pickers, and again, these women are looking at her with respect. She writes her friends in New York about the day that she walked into this crab house, and she said, we were getting one of our family's houseboats painted, and I went next door to the crab picking house, and it was amazing. And she said, this is what I want to do. I want to paint black people. And she said her friend Mabel Dwight would have had an absolute field day, and she talked about how warmly she was received, and this is what she wanted to do. Sally DeShields was a cook for the family, and she wrote about how Sally had more knowledge than anyone that she ever knew. And this is her house, which we know exactly where this was in Unionville. Downs Curtis, we have the study and the finished product, was one of the first professional black sailmakers. He was in Oxford, Maryland, and this is his studio on Tillman Street. His brother was a sailmaker, and his wife is 94-year-old lady called Frances Curtis, who's a Tubman descendant, who's been unbelievably helpful in telling the story. You know, Jeffrey, Miss Frances, Paulette Albury, you know, these are really families that have helped us unearth this knowledge.
So what do we know about Hell's Crossing?
It's the African-American neighborhood in St. Michael's. They called it Crab Alley or Hell's Crossing.
Actually, Barbara knows more about it than I do. I can speak more on the African-American spiritual, you know, work and my family.
Wow. So what do we know about her family now?
So she has a granddaughter called Brenda Rose, who really represents the family trust. And she very kindly gave the museum the IP rights to this show and to the use in the catalog as well, which Nina helped write. And then there's a great nephew called Nathan Kernan, who's been extremely helpful with information. She makes 14 lithographs to honor African-American soldiers and their service in World War II, which is, again, really quite unprecedented. She also does, they're all with spiritual names. This one here is called I Couldn't Hear Nobody Pray. And when you read her notes, she says this man isn't abandoning his post. He's the last one. He knows he's going to die, but he's going to stay and die because of his religious belief. Then she says, you know, we kind of kidnapped him from the jungle 200 years ago, and now we ask him to go back to the jungle to die for his country. These are about the temptations of African-American young men as they're living in an unjust world. Some stories, I guess, never quite die. You can see this one here, sometimes I feel like a motherless child. He's just trying to get home, but problems are jumping in his path, and you can see that the scales of justice have been tipped. So this is a lovely one. This is Joshua fought the Battle of Jericho, and this is Joe Lewis defeating Max Schmeling. So you can see here, she says, I consider this a failure. So she goes to all the trouble to grind this stone, and they say you don't have it quite right. And she grinds it down again to just reorganize, to give him surer footing, and reorganize the audience here. And that's the second.
And Max Schmeling is like, who was a German part of the Nazi world who fought Joe Lewis, is kind of painted as the devil.
Yes, well, that's, and again, you can see angels of mixed race.
When you say grind down the stone, what do you mean?
She had to go right back literally to the drawing board to re-get...
Okay. Not literally grinding down stone.
Well, she was pretty much, yeah. Now, she's great friends with a woman called Mary Cabot Wheelwright, who creates the Museum of the American Indian in Santa Fe. and she's attending Navajo spirituals. Roostar Rose isn't just confined to Maryland, so this last space really honors her work in the world. She goes to Mexico, where she's in a giant cathedral, where studying Black Christ of Mexico, and she said, "I care about the dark races of humanity and their religious belief. That's what I want to do, and I want to create a universal brotherhood." So it goes back to what Ted Mack has always said about kind of one history. So right now we're just playing catch up with African American history to kind of level the playing field. This is a beautiful color lithograph of a Florida Seminole woman, and here's a letter that was written by the woman Laverne Madigan, who was the director of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, about the nobility and the confidence that just come right out of this picture that was given to her. Roostar Rose's mother, her family were abolitionists, and her mother was quite a dynamic woman and wrote a 2-volume book called Gardens of the Caribbean. She takes, of her 6 children, her 2 daughters, on a long, very elaborate tour of the West Indies on a luxury boat. But they go to Hindu rituals in Trinidad. They go to Haiti. They go to visit a leper colony while they're on Martinique. So the book is in many ways about everything but Caribbean gardens, but it reveals to you a sense of social responsibility. They're watching young women load coal onto their luxury ship, and men are giving them a hard time and throwing coins in the water, expecting them to catch them in their mouths. And she said, "Frankly, I've seen more immodesty in women on a ballroom floor than I've seen in these women." This is Rosendo of Mexico. So, I mean, again, it's just a boy who is clean, well-presented, confident, and leading his life happily.
If the paintings aren't here, where do they live? Where are these paintings?
They're mostly in a private collection.
Yeah. In one private collection?
No, multiple. And the fresco belongs now to the Long Woods Church, which is near Copperville. It's near Easton. Yeah, that was a remarkable piece to move.
So I'm just thinking about that in terms of what it took to kind of pull this whole exhibit together, to find all these paintings.
Well, Nina and I spent over 10 years traipsing all over the planet. I mean, some of this was in Bath, England. Some was in New York. I mean, it was really quite a journey. This is a letter from Laverne Madigan where she said, "It's impossible for me to thank you adequately for giving us the disturbingly beautiful picture of the Seminole woman. I am looking at it as I write. Built right into the bones of those Florida Indians is a stateliness. Their dignified esteem for themselves as human beings and Seminoles has so far remained impervious to the historical forces that made Indians of so many other tribes who doubt their own worth. Their utter lack of fear and illusion shows in their calm, direct glance." And then she says, "But why do I go on? You've built that into the picture. Why am I doing this?" So over here is a wonderful article. This is in the newspaper in Haiti in 1956, where Roostar Rose goes as a guest of Lois Malu Jones. And in this article, they're announcing that this grand dame, Roostar Rose, who's just been on The Voice of America and has had a solo show at Howard University, is about to visit Haiti. And they say that she's just come from a nearly year-long tour of Europe and Great Britain with Mary Cabot Wheelwright, where they were studying the intersection of African art and Native American art, looking for spiritual symbols. So this catalog right here is from a museum in Arles. Roostar Rose writes her friend, Harlem Renaissance artist Prentice Taylor, saying, "I've just seen the most amazing exhibition on African art. I'm in the south of France. It's 1954. I'm with Mary Cabot Wheelwright, and this is actually the catalog from that exhibition."
Over the years of covering art exhibits, I'm always blown away by what it takes to be a curator and what curators do to put together an exhibit, which is an incredible amount of work. And it's just an amazing way to lead your life, or do parts of your life. And just also the story that's right here in our backyard in the Eastern Shore. This woman who I never heard of before.
That says a lot.
This is amazing. So I understand this exhibit's going to go to the Eastern Shore next, right?
Yeah. Yeah, Richard Marks he's organizing it to come over to Talbot County late April. It's going to be here at the Lewis Museum until April 3rd, and then it'll be heading over to the Eastern Shore. So, and I have to say that Eddie Brown has been the mensch of all menches in this thing. I mean, Ted was the one who really brought this to the museum as board member. And one of the first meetings that we had was with Eddie Brown, and without hesitation, he supported this project. And he's also not just somebody who wrote a check. He was someone with whom we had a great kind of intellectual banter. And, I mean, so many people went into the making of the catalog.
I want to give a huge thank you to the Reginald F. Lewis Museum for inviting us to take a trip through this exhibit with our amazing guest for this hour, family descendant Jeffrey Mone, guest exhibition curator Dr. Barbara Paca, Lewis Museum board member Ted Mack, and Lewis Museum executive director Skip Sanders. Ruth Star Rose, Revelations of African American Life in Maryland and the World, runs through April 3rd of next year. More information about the museum and the exhibit, visit rflewismuseum.org. We have to take a very brief break here, and when we come back, it's the latest installment from our series The World of the Play with Everyman Theater. We're looking at some of the issues inside of August Wilson's play, Fences. Don't want to miss this fascinating conversation, so stay with us. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com.